Hey there, it's Shannon Ballard. Southern Mysteries is an independent podcast made possible by the support of patrons who help me continue to share stories like the one you'll hear today. I appreciate all my patrons, including our newest members, Alyssa Leslie from Port Orchard, Washington, Veronica Martins from Willow Spring, North Carolina, Julie Vineyard from Woodstock, Georgia, Laura Blackberg from Tallahassee, Florida, Justine Richards from Oakland, Oregon, Gina Harbison from Penton, Alabama, Casey Wilborn from Henniger, Alabama, and to new patrons listening and supporting from mysterious locations, Catherine Simonson, Angela Tinker, Cecilia Busick, Char, and K&M Emery. Thank you for your support. When you join in supporting the show on Patreon, you can hear ad-free episodes and the show archive of the first three seasons. You can also join at a level where you have access to lots of bonus content like the archives of patron-exclusive podcast and the patron-exclusive monthly podcast, Audacious, Tales of Scandalous and Shocking Crimes in American History. There are two options for joining on Patreon, and it's easy to opt in and out. See for yourself and start listening to episodes you haven't heard yet at patreon.com/southernmysteries. On the evening of May 4th, 1931, William and Mamie Wagner were murdered at their home in Northwest Mississippi. The Jackson Clarion Ledger called the murders of one of the most prominent couples in the area the most brutal tragedy that has ever happened in this section of Mississippi. Welcome to Southern Mysteries, exploring history and mysteries of the American South. I'm your host, Shannon Ballard. This is the mystery of the Wagner murders in Water Valley, Mississippi. Water Valley is a small town in Yallabusha County in Northwest Mississippi. The town's about 25 minutes outside of Oxford. The area was settled in 1834, following the passage of the Indian Removal Act of 1830. The region had been the homeland of the Choctaw and Chickasaw tribes until two treaties with the federal government led to their removal. A small number of white settlers built cabins on the land that would officially be named Water Valley in 1847. A stagecoach stand was opened, and throughout the 1840s, the town grew, with businesses, doctors, lawyers, and more merchants establishing stores along Main Street. In 1852, the Mississippi Central Railroad was chartered to open a new rail line between New Orleans and Jackson, Tennessee. The town, knowing the line would mean big business for Water Valley, continued to grow throughout the 1850s, with the first hotel opening, followed by a drugstore and several churches. In 1858, Water Valley was officially incorporated, and by 1860, the Mississippi Central Railroad was completed. Passenger and commercial trains rolled through town daily. In 1860, the census listed the population of Water Valley at about 300 people. This growing community had just started to prosper when the Civil War began. The town was occupied by Union soldiers in 1862, and throughout the war, most of the buildings in Water Valley were destroyed or damaged, along with the vital Mississippi Central Railroad. Following the war, the railroad was rebuilt, and the establishment of new businesses brought hundreds of new workers and their families to Water Valley. In 1920, Water Valley's population reached just over 4,300 people. But the Great Depression and loss of railroads in the late 1920s and early 1930s led to an economic decline, with the population declining to just over 3,700 in 1930. Water Valley wouldn't come back from that economic decline until the early 2000s, when residents from nearby Oxford sought cheaper housing options. They moved to Water Valley, opened new businesses along Main Street, and began buying and restoring Water Valley's historic Victorian and Colonial Revival homes. Water Valley's growth following the Civil War led families from the northern parts of the United States to relocate and pursue a new chapter. This was true for William and Molly Wagner. They moved from Pennsylvania to Water Valley after the war. Mr. Wagner worked as a respected ticket agent for the Mississippi Central Railroad. The couple welcomed their son, William Buford Wagner, in 1867. In 1902, William married Mamie Heron in Water Valley. By 1903, they had two sons, but one died in 1910 at the age of seven. William Buford Wagner was a prominent citizen of Water Valley. He would become the president of the Bank of Water Valley in 1915, own the popular Wagner's Department Store, and became a primary stockholder in the town's twine mill, which fostered respect due to the job security the mill afforded many citizens. The Wagners led a privileged life. Newspapers shared many stories of Mamie traveling up and down the East Coast on excursions with her son, William, along with cousins and sisters-in-laws. William Wagner Jr., who preferred to be called Bill, also traveled the world thanks to his father's success and wealth. On the evening of May 4th, 1931, everything changed for the Wagner family. William and Mamie were murdered at their home in Water Valley. Newspapers across the state, including the Jackson Clarion Ledger, carried headlines about the murder, calling it one of the most brutal tragedies that had happened in this section of Mississippi. The Water Valley Presbyterian Church overflowed with friends and relatives who gathered to pay their final respects before the Wagners were laid to rest in Oak Hill Cemetery. Sadly, their son Bill was unable to attend the funeral. At the time his parents died, Bill was working in Honduras. He sailed from Honduras on May 7th and arrived in the port of New Orleans on May 11th. When he arrived in Water Valley on May 12th, Sheriff C.T. Doyle met with Bill and promised he would get swift justice for his parents. The heinous murder of Mamie and William Wagner was headline news across the region. But there were whispers around town that William Wagner's temper may have led to the murder, and his wife may have gotten caught up in the middle of a situation. William Wagner was very respected in Water Valley. He contributed to the town's economic growth, but he had a reputation as a man who could lose control of his temper. He was even accused of being responsible for the death of a pastor in 1899. Reverend H.P. Gibbs spoke out against William Wagner's uncle, Daniel, and the Wagner family management of the mill. The Methodist pastor was appalled by horrifying accounts of child labor at the mill and took to the pulpit to call out the management of the mill and demand the practice end. Daniel Wagner tried to talk to Reverend Gibbs and the mill managers to make peace regarding the situation. But he claimed Reverend Gibbs continued to agitate mill workers and managers to the point the company asked for and obtained an injunction against Gibbs visiting the mill or any Wagner business. When the Reverend was seen near a Wagner business, Daniel Wagner claimed he was seized with an irresistible impulse, which he could not control, and slapped the Reverend in the face. William Wagner and one of the Wagner business partners rushed to Reverend Gibbs, who was now sitting in his buggy. They asked if he planned to cease writing slanderous articles against the family and the mill. Reverend Gibbs replied he would continue to share what he knew was happening. William Wagner responded by striking Reverend Gibbs several times. He had to be pulled away from the attack by his uncle Daniel and another man and taken away from the scene. Over the following weeks, Reverend Gibbs went about his business, kept speaking out against the Wagners, preaching and writing as he always had, until he became ill. Doctors said he had congestive malarial fever, which was complicated with pneumonia in both lungs. 20 days later, Reverend Gibbs died. Immediately, claims were made in town that the death of Reverend Gibbs was somehow the result of the blows from William Wagner. Sensational stories appeared in newspapers which claimed Wagner's assault, directly or indirectly, caused the death of the moral man. In May 1899, a reporter from the Memphis Commercial Appeal shared the results of his investigation into those claims, including interviews with the attending physicians for Reverend Gibbs. The physicians maintained there was no connection between the slap, the assaults, and the Reverend's death. In the end, the Methodist newspaper, The Headlight, wrote of Reverend Gibbs' passing, "A congested liver, a malignant form or congested fever, and pneumonia in both lungs led to his death. All of this was more than the strong man could stand." William Wagner may not have been directly responsible, but that was something that came up often when he would let his temper get the best of him. People would recall the time he attacked a pastor, and there were other instances of William Wagner's temper ruling his response to people in the community. So much so that when news spread about the murder of William Wagner, there was an attitude about town that Wagner may have hit the wrong person, someone who decided to fight back and killed Mamie Wagner because she could identify them. On the morning of May 5th, 1931, the Wagner's housekeeper, Callie Wiggins, arrived early at the house, as she always did, to prepare breakfast for the Wagners. When Callie opened the door, she immediately noticed furniture was turned over and ran from the house after she saw blood on the floor. She ran to a neighbor's house and asked them to call for Sheriff C.T. Doyle. Doyle responded along with the city marshal and found evidence of a serious crime. There were bloody footprints on the floors of the Wagner's home, furniture overturned from what appeared to be a serious fight, but there was no sign of William or Mamie Wagner. Based on the amount of blood in and around the house and the discovery of a blood-stained axe, investigators assumed they were looking for murder victims. News spreads quickly in small towns. A crowd gathered outside of the Wagner property and watched as investigators came in and out. Neighbors offered to help search for William and Mamie Wagner, which led to the discovery of a body in a shallow grave in the garden behind their house. Investigators uncovered the body of William Wagner, whose skull had been crushed behind his left ear. His forehead had been bashed in, and there was a gash from the right side of his forehead down his left cheek. Authorities were certain the fatal blows had come from the axe found at the scene. Investigators continued to search for Mamie Wagner. When the sheriff opened and searched the couple's garage, he found more blood. There was a bloody handprint on the light bulb hanging inside, and blood inside the couple's Chevy sedan. The blood inside the vehicle indicated Mamie Wagner may have been transported from the scene, which made no sense to investigators. Why bury William on the property in a shallow grave, but take Mamie somewhere else? The sheriff called on volunteers to help search for Mamie Wagner. Soon, they found her body in a deep ravine, 2 miles from the Wagner home. Mamie had cuts all over her head, along with bruises across her body, and her throat had been slashed. The town of Water Valley was closed by order of Sheriff Doyle. He worried the killer or killers may still be in town and attempt to escape. He also ordered his men to keep watch over the presumed murder weapon, that bloody axe. He wanted to make sure no one else touched it, just in case fingerprints on the handle could lead to a suspect. Authorities were certain that the murder of William and Mamie Wagner was motivated by revenge. Their deaths indicated someone harbored rage against them. Detectives John Fox and Eugene Wagner were called in from Memphis, Tennessee, to assist Sheriff Doyle with the investigation. Eugene Wagner was William Wagner's nephew. Now, the first interview was with the person who discovered the crime scene, the Wagner's housekeeper, Callie Wiggins. In the 1930s, details of the investigation were printed in True Detective magazine, including transcripts of interviews. Sheriff Doyle and detectives noted Callie's recall of details that morning proved helpful in their investigation. Callie was asked if she knew of anyone who had a grudge against her employers, would want to hurt them. And Callie said she did not. They questioned Callie at length and were about to wrap up the interview when one of the detectives returned to something Callie had casually mentioned. She said the only person she had seen around the Wagner's house on the morning she arrived was Sam Whitaker. The 18-year-old worked for the Wagners as an occasional driver, and he did yard work for them. The sheriff asked why Sam would be at the Wagners so early in the morning. Callie explained jaybirds had been picking at Mr. Wagner's cherries, so Sam had brought a slingshot to rid the orchard of pest. The sheriff asked Callie if Sam said anything to her, and she did remember that Sam greeted her and then mentioned the Wagners weren't home and there wasn't any use for her to even go in the house. Authorities thanked Callie for her help and brought in Sam Whitaker for questioning. Sheriff Doyle asked Sam what he knew about the murders. Sam replied he knew nothing and had been at home when it happened. This line of questioning went back and forth for about an hour. Sam was asked why he had blood on his shoes, to which he replied he must have stepped in it somewhere. When asked to show his hands, Sheriff Doyle noticed what he believed to be dried blood under Sam's fingernails. Fingerprints were taken from Sam for comparison to prints found on the axe and on the light bulb in the garage. And footprints were taken for comparison to prints found all across the property. Sam's footprints and fingerprints matched. But this alone was not enough evidence to get a conviction for double murder. Sam worked on the property, and there was a reasonable assumption that his prints would be found in the garage since he drove for the Wagners. Sheriff Doyle called Sam Whitaker back in for questioning and asked him the direct question, "Did you kill the Wagners?" Sam Whitaker hesitated and then said, "Mr. Wagner slapped me Monday for stealing his gun. He told me he was going to whip me the next day, so I took his axe and went into the house last night." When pushed by Sheriff Doyle to continue, Sam said the following, "I found Mrs. Wagner in the dining room, and I struck her over the head. She fell across the dining room table. I heard someone coming and ran to the back door, leaving Mrs. Wagner on the floor in her room. It was Mr. Wagner at the back porch. I hit him on the head with the axe, and he fell. Emmett Shaw was waiting for me in the yard. He helped me carry Mr. Wagner out, and we found a shovel in the garage. We buried him in the backyard in a shallow grave because we knew we didn't have much time." Authorities looked into Emmett Shaw and found he had worked for and been fired by Mr. Wagner after he was caught stealing. Emmett was working for a chain gang at the time of the Wagner's murder, but he had trustee status, which meant he was not in jail at night. Deputies were sent to search for Emmett Shaw as the detectives and Sheriff Doyle continued to interrogate Sam Whitaker, who kept talking. Sam said his sister Adele Whitaker came upon the scene where Emmett and Sam were burying William Wagner. According to Sam, they forced her to help them before Sam went back into the Wagner house. They knew Callie would arrive soon to make the Wagner's breakfast, and they were running out of time. Mamie Wagner was on the floor, groaning in pain. According to Sam, he and Emmett picked up Mamie Wagner and carried her out to the garage. When he walked in, he reached up to turn on the light so they could see how to put Mamie in the car. Sam told Detective Fox he was the one who drove the car a couple of miles until they got to the area where they could dump Mamie's body. Sam and Emmett pulled her from the car and hurled her over the ravine. Just before they returned to the car, Sam claimed he heard Mamie groaning. He climbed down into the ravine and slashed her throat in what he said was an act of mercy to put her out of her misery. Deputies tracked down Emmett Shaw and brought him in for questioning. When Emmett was told he was implicated as an accomplice in the murder of the Wagners, he denied any involvement. He referred to the Wagners as good people he would never harm. But when pushed by Sheriff Doyle to prove where he had been the night before, Emmett Shaw could not offer an answer. When Adele Whitaker was brought in for questioning, she admitted she called on her brother at the Wagners and ended up being forced into helping bury Mr. Wagner. Adele's confession was in line with her brother's, which convinced the detectives and Sheriff Doyle that Sam Whitaker, Emmett Shaw, and Adele Whitaker were guilty of the murders and the disposal of the bodies. The detectives once again questioned Sam Whitaker, who said previous violent attacks against him by William Wagner and William's chastisement of him for not returning a borrowed gun led to his rage and the murder he planned with Emmett Shaw. Sheriff Doyle knew word would spread quickly of the confession of Sam Whitaker, his implication of Emmett Shaw, and Adele Whitaker's confession. The fact that all three suspects, who would be charged in connection with the murder of two prominent white members of Water Valley community, were black, meant Doyle had to tread carefully. Doyle feared a mob could try to lynch all three suspects. He openly spoke of doing his best to prevent more violence and protect the suspects so they could face a fair trial. A suspect in a Water Valley crime had been lynched in 1921 and named in the Dyer Anti-Lynching Bill, introduced to Congress in 1921 and again in 1922. The bill aimed to make lynching a federal crime, but it failed to pass as opponents claimed it was an issue that should be left to the states. Sheriff Doyle knew there was a strong possibility that the community in Water Valley or Yallabusha County could respond by attempting to take the suspects from the jail to lynch them. Sheriff Doyle decided to secretly transport all three suspects from the Water Valley jail and hand them over to Greenwood Sheriff Sam Coleman. They were placed in the protection of the LaFleur County Jail. During Sam Whitaker's transport to Greenwood, the suspect continued to add to his confession. When asked what happened in the room when he attacked Mamie, Sam Whitaker reportedly told Doyle that after the first blow to Mrs. Wagner, when she was knocked across the dining room table, Sam noticed the tablecloth was covered in blood. He removed it to hide it in the clothes hamper. Once Sam Whitaker was in custody in LaFleur County, Sheriff Doyle called on a deputy and told him to search for this evidence in a hamper at the Wagner home. It was exactly where Sam Whitaker said it would be and would serve as corroborative evidence of the crime. Sam Whitaker and Emmett Shaw were indicted for first-degree murder. Adele Whitaker was indicted on charges of accessory to murder after the fact. They were transported back to Water Valley for their trials in June 1931. Emmett Shaw pled not guilty, while Sam Whitaker's defense pled not guilty by reason of insanity. The prosecution chose to try Sam Whitaker for the murder of William Wagner and Emmett Shaw for the murder of Mamie Wagner. In both cases, the prosecution claimed revenge was the motive for murder. There had initially been reports that nearly 100 state troops would be guarding the courthouse during the trial to prevent mob violence. But Sheriff Doyle requested the Mississippi governor call those troops back. He feared state troops being on the scene would further rile up the community and lead to violence. Sheriff Doyle called on support from neighboring police departments to patrol the area and be on the lookout for any sign of a mob organizing. Throughout the trials that followed, there was no violence, but there was a palpable feeling of anger in and around the courtroom as the trials progressed. 18-year-old Sam Whitaker stood trial first. The damning evidence against him, his multiple confessions, the testimony of Wagner's cook, and the lack of evidence to show Sam was mentally unsound at the time of the murders led to a quick verdict. The jury deliberated just 11 minutes before returning a guilty verdict. The next day, 35-year-old Emmett Shaw stood trial. Within 6 minutes of the case being handed over for deliberation, the jury returned a guilty verdict. When 16-year-old Adele Whitaker stood trial, she too was found guilty. Adele was sentenced to 5 years in the Mississippi State Prison at Parchman. Sam Whitaker and Emmett Shaw were sentenced to death by hanging. The sentence was carried out at the Little Brick Jail in Water Valley on July 17, 1931. Authorities maintain this was an open and shut case, as solid as they come, with strong evidence presented at trial. Sam Whitaker's matching finger and footprints, dried blood found under his fingernails, the blood-covered tablecloth that Sam revealed to be hidden in the Wagner home, and Sam's numerous and very detailed confessions. But there are some who believe to this day that not everyone convicted of this crime deserve their sentence. Some argue Sam, Emmett, and Adele did not receive a fair trial, and there may have been others involved. It is complicated when you consider Sam Whitaker's numerous statements of confession included not only the implication of Emmett Shaw as an accessory to murder. In two separate interviews, Sam had claimed three young white men were also involved in the crime. Sam also later changed his statement to say Emmett Shaw did not help him and there were no white accomplices involved. There was direct evidence linking Sam Whitaker to the crime scene, but that was not the case for Emmett Shaw. He maintained his innocence, even as he stood on the gallows and was executed. Sam and Emmett were denied of any chance of an appeal and died with the question of whether or not one or both participated in the murders or cover-up lingering over the case. There was also the questionable decision by Mississippi authorities to allow William Wagner's nephew to be one of the primary detectives working the case and interrogating suspects. Folks will always wonder if that decision compromised the investigation and led the investigating team to ignore Sam Whitaker's retraction of his statement, along with his retraction of Emmett Shaw helping murder the Wagners. But the truth is, we'll never know. Southern Mysteries is created and hosted by me, Shannon Ballard. The grisly murders of William and Mamie Wagner were hard to process in small-town Water Valley in the 1930s. Crimes of this kind were rare, especially the level of violence inflicted on the victims. It was just tragic all around. William and Mamie Wagner's son, Bill, left Water Valley after the trials. He returned to Honduras and eventually returned to the States. He married and moved to Louisiana, where he died in 1979 at the age of 76. The Water Valley of today is such a charming town. If you ever get the chance to visit, I'd encourage you to visit during the summer so you can experience the Watermelon Carnival. The town's population increases from just over 3,300 to more than 20,000 people during that carnival. The history behind it is interesting, too. The carnival was founded in 1931 to try to boost town morale after the Water Valley Bank failed, the railroad left, and unemployment was running high during the Great Depression. The community just wanted to come together and do something positive to help each other feel better. And they're still doing that today. The carnival is a weekend full of street dances, food, fireworks, and folks just plan their entire year around being there. You can check out the Water Valley Chamber of Commerce for more information about the carnival. I'll drop that link along with all the sources for this episode that you can find in the full show notes at southernmysteries.com. Hey, if you're enjoying Southern Mysteries, I encourage you to rate and review the show where you're listening, which helps stir up the podcast algorithms and helps other people discover the show. And make sure you hit the follow button where you're listening so you never miss a new episode. Each episode you hear is made possible with the help of the core support from our Southern Mysteries patrons who love these stories and want to hear more. So if you want to learn more about supporting the show on Patreon and accessing episodes that are only available to patrons, a lot of content is there that you're not going to hear anywhere else. You can check that out at patreon.com/southernmysteries. as always, thank you so much for listening.